Welcome to the Vibe Lifter podcast. I'm Tish, one of the Reglan Food co-founders, and I'm here to help lift your vibe with inspiring stories from people out in their local communities doing good mahi. So settle in and let's meet our guest of the day. Today, we're chatting with Matthew Shrimpman, scientist, founder of Aim High Education, Edmund Hillary Fellow, and collector of many random and delightful facts about the natural world. Kia ora, Matthew. It's lovely to have you here at the factory and also in Raglan at large as part of your Great New Zealand tour.
Oh, kia ora, Tash. Thank you for making me feel endlessly welcome by welcoming me into your home, feeding me, parking me in front of a fire, warming me up, and then sending me into the world to experience the waves and the people of Raglan. Oh, so great here.
Yeah, you're enjoying it?
Is this podcast an advertisement for Raglan?
Well, yes, in a small way.
That's part of the strategy. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it is. We're really luring good. You here.
I am lured.
And we're number one on the spreadsheet now, I think. What are you saying? No, number two in the rankings.
For Bella, you're number one. My rankings are irrelevant.
Oh.
If you'd like to know my rankings of favourite places in New Zealand to live.
Yes.
Well, I really like Nelson.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Well, I like it too. I can't really argue with you. It is lovely.
It's got a good old science park. They're studying all the things to do with living things in water.
Yeah, we can't compete with that. We don't have one of those here. Damn it.
It's pretty cool. They're doing everything from like what's in the sea to like what's in the rivers. They're probably doing what's in the rain as well.
Okay. Well, we'll keep trying to win you in other areas.
Well, as I said, what I think is irrelevant. So if Bella likes Raglan, then Raglan
wins. Raglan it is. Yeah. Huzzah. So what is it about Aotearoa that even enticed you here in general over from the UK in the first place?
Well, family.
Yeah.
My twin fled to these realms many years ago.
Oh, I didn't even know. Where is the twin living?
Well, she's actually in Sydney, and I know that's actually practically pretty far away.
Similar realm.
I was going to say, compared to the UK, it's much closer to here. And other families scattered about the islands.
Yep.
That's been a big thing, because I like to go where there's some family.
It helps.
I know that's maybe a bit rude to places where my family aren't, but they just can't be everywhere.
They can't. There's only so many Shrimpmans.
There's only so many. But yeah, there's that. And if you've asked this question to others, you'll probably hear this a lot, but especially to EHF fellows who I know have been drawn in by this, but particularly the kind of indigenous interweaving with the culture, I think there's something very special about that.
Yes.
And I think it makes people feel, especially those working in climate and nature, that there's some real potential for some magic here, because there's already, all the way up to the surface, this very strong understanding of the importance of us working more closely with nature. So that's pretty big. Soil's good here.
Yes.
Good soil.
And you know a lot about soil.
Good nutrients, good memories.
Yes.
It seems. Mm-hmm. Different kinds of memories in the soil here. That's good. And also, one of the things that I've noticed loads is New Zealand seems to be a place that gathers a lot of people who are interested in lots of different things.
Yes. Quite eclectic.
I find that in somewhere like the UK, people tend to really deeply specialize, which of course you need to do if you want to get really far into any field. But I think that in New Zealand, there's more of a sense of playfulness in that it seems quite normal to like have a go at lots of different things because you're bringing knowledge from all kinds of different areas. And I really like that spirit. I think it's good for me because I'm not very good at just like going really hard on one single thing. I like to be quite playful and like draw lots of different ideas together. And so that kind of suits me pretty well. And I feel like that kind of seems to be the vibe. Is that your vibe?
Yeah, so right. We are a country of generalists.
Yeah.
So welcome. You are one of us.
Yeah.
I'm also wondering what inspired you to start Aim High? Because I haven't actually asked you this before. And how has it evolved? Because it's been going for what, 4 years now?
And can I start this with a different story?
Of course.
A question. Do you know how spiders fly? Some spiders.
How spiders fly? Nope. I was going to take a stab, but no. I mean, I anticipate it's something to do with their web spinning abilities that give them flying powers, or at least the appearance of flying. They might not actually be flying.
They're kind of flying.
Okay. They're literally flying.
Yeah.
Okay. Tell me more.
The story goes, Darwin, your boy, he's on his boat on the Beagle.
Okay.
He's approaching Argentina, I think.
Mm-hmm.
and it's still like a couple hundred miles off the coast. And there are loads of spiders boarding the boat, commandeering it to take it over or somewhat. He's kind of thinking, like, how on earth are these things getting here? We're so far from the land.
Yeah.
And he sees that they've all got these like large kind of strands of web above them. Mm-hmm. And they're kind of floating on these things. Anyway, this led to this idea called ballooning.
Okay.
And the idea was that these bits of silk create like this kind of parachute.
Mm-hmm.
And the parachute allows the spiders to like fly
cool.
on the wind. This was the theory for quite a long time.
Yeah.
But then if you think about it, it doesn't make that much sense because like the wind is just as likely to carry the spider up as it is to dump it into the ocean, right?
Mm, it's also very fragile as a parachute.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. There's pretty strong spider silk.
Mm.
It's one of the only materials that will like suspend its weight. If you had to have like a rope from a satellite down to the Earth's surface, then most things would snap under their own weight. But spider silk would, or at least golden orb weaver silk wouldn't.
Wow, that's very specific. Okay.
I was going to say, that's quite specific. Anyway, back to the Darwin story.
Yeah, so all these spiders have shown up, taking over the boat.
They've showed up. So we used to think they were like making these like parachute balloony things.
Yeah.
But it didn't quite make sense. And so more recently, this idea came about and it's now been proven that spiders have these kind of like electrically sensitive hairs on their legs. And so they can feel when the electric field of the earth is getting quite strong.
Whoa.
And so you know how the ground's a bit negative and the sky's a bit kind of positive?
Yeah.
So when they can feel it's getting really strong, they'll sometimes climb up really high and then they'll shoot a single strand of silk up into the air. And as they do so, they'll cover it in negative charge. And so that strand of silk will literally repel the ground and attract the sky. And so they'll just lift up into the sky like a magnet, and then they can just float on the wind for hundreds or even thousands of miles.
This is so cool. I feel like you have the best spider effects. I loved your silk hinge that you sent in a newsletter at some point. I was like, this is nuts. This exists, a silk hinge. They make those. We don't know why. I mean, like, the stuff is gold.
Yeah, for anyone listening, definitely Google silk hinge at some stage. You'll enjoy it. Like, going back to the spiders thing, like, imagine if we'd all learned about static electricity in that way at school rather than rubbing two pieces of plastic together.
Yeah.
Like, you can't get more artificial than the way that we learned it. And yet it's essentially the same story.
Yeah, but way more interesting.
So viewing the world through this kind of nature lens is immensely powerful, not just in terms of sparking imagination and providing really deep learning, but in terms of how effectively it can change the way that we see the world and its overarching systems. I'm going to ask you another question.
Oh, okay. I don't think I'm going to get to ask you any questions in this interview. What have you got?
Do you know what imaginal cells are?
Imaginal cells?
Imaginal cells.
It doesn't sound real, but no, I don't know what they are.
So my friend Phoebe Tickle, who's another EHF fellow, you might have met her actually.
No, I haven't met Phoebe.
She taught me about these the other day. They're the cells in a caterpillar that all get activated and link up when it's time for it to break down and metamorphose. When it's time for it to transition from a hungry, some might say, greedy, chomping creature into something different.
Mm.
Now, if humanity is that caterpillar, then it's kind of time for us to be those cells, right? And I'm not talking about like anarchy and collapse. I'm talking about architectured, creative transformation into a greater form. And I'm not talking about a total break from the past either, because you might already know, you probably already know this, that when caterpillars become butterflies, they don't lose their memories, they retain them. But they do change what they're looking for and how they live. Now, how do we trigger and guide this happening in a society that's much bigger and much more complex than a caterpillar?
Mm.
And for me, the answer is education.
Yes.
Now, you've likely heard the H.G. Wells quote where he says something like, civilization is in a constant race between education and catastrophe.
Yes.
And for me, we're in this place where education is kind of losing.
Mm.
And all the times in history, we need people to be learning and wanting to be learned. Our education systems at the moment are seriously antiquated. We're like very Victorian style schools are still training people up to do really repetitive things as if this is the industrial
revolution. Still training for the army and working in factories.
And a lot of people I know are worrying about AI and how we'll compete with the machines. But I think that's it's not the wrong kind of thinking, but I think it's important to recognize that in the future, what will allow us to thrive isn't our ability to iterate really repetitive tasks and memorize and regurgitate Googleable facts. Instead, at this inflection point, we need to be doubling down on what makes us human, embracing what makes us different rather than all the same.
So yes,
we need people to be better innovators, critical thinkers, problem solvers, whole systems thinkers, and able to bridge silos and empathetic relationship builders and composites of all those things. And instead, we're training people up to be machines. And we've been doing so for such a long time now, it's no wonder that we're in the mess that we're in now.
But then how do you go from being a person that cares about that? You know, you're obviously having those thoughts and going, okay, I wish I could do something, you know, how do I educate? How do I inspire? But then you actually started something. So what was the genesis of actually beginning? Or how did you even, was it like a course? Was it an online class? Was it in person? What was the initial aim high?
So I was cycling through an almost empty London.
Okay.
Knowing the world was about to change pretty radically with COVID. It was really mysterious, actually. But I'd kind of been involved in quite a few things before, like education and broadcast and science presenting and music and, and impact venture building stuff. I was trying to think, like, how could I bring all of those things together to do something useful? I was also thinking a lot about fictions, about how, like Yuval Harari talks in Sapiens, probably many listeners have read that, about how we humans kind of orient quite well around fictions.
Mythology.
And I was kind of thinking about how I really enjoy doing science communication.
Yes.
But as a white male, putting myself at the center of that didn't necessarily feel like the right way to carry on doing it. And I figured if I created a fiction, as in an organization that does communication of science and knowledge, then I could still do that kind of work, but I could get other faces and other people involved. And so I was kind of, I know that's maybe like way too cerebral a way to think about it, but I was kind of like gathering all those thoughts together.
Yeah.
And then obviously, yeah, COVID happened and I saw how kids in the UK just like had really terrible learning resources, especially those who were not like, didn't have the fortunes of like being privately educated and all that kind of stuff. And because I'd done a lot of online learning stuff before, I just set up this nonprofit to do science and maths education, a little bit of English. And so that was the first thing that was running. And it was going quite well. It was quite popular, but I was just really drawn back towards doing all the climate and nature stuff because it had been the world that I was working in before. And obviously, I think it's something that many people I speak to kind of agree on. It just feels like a real responsibility to be working in that space now.
Yes.
I was chatting to Nate, another fellow, a few days ago, and he was talking about how he would just be doing poetry and things like that if it weren't for the climate and nature emergency. Aww. I was saying how I would be just studying cosmology. I just want to do physics. I think we'd be doing totally different things.
Right, but you feel this pull to have that kind of impact and contribute in that way.
Yeah. Mm. So I wrote all that material. And then we were running it for kids and, and that was going reasonably well. I kind of had this idea of like, let's get it into loads of different schools and try and kind of move it across the whole of the UK education system. But working with schools is just so frictional because teachers don't have the resources. Yeah. And it's just like such a kind of fractured world. And so much as I had really good intentions there, it just felt like a very difficult thing to do. And so we carried on trying with that. But at the same time, I was thinking about how in the civil service in the UK and in government, if you want to communicate something between departments, that is like a separate topic to what people are used to, then the rule is that it has to be understandable to like an 11 or 13 year old. And I was thinking, sensible. Yeah. I was thinking, well, all our stuff is understandable.
Yeah, we're already operating to that level. We can take this a bit higher.
So we teamed up with the University of Cambridge and we got a group from the House of Lords together.
Oh, House of Lords.
And we basically ran the material for them and we told them it was for them.
Yeah.
But it was just
the same stuff.
It was just the stuff for kids. Yeah. We just changed a few words here and there. And I was kind of wondering, like, how is this going to go down? But it went great. Like it was, I remember the feeling of after each session, these peers from like different sides of the bench from different opposing parties would suddenly start talking to one another about things that it felt like there had been a huge amount of friction on before.
Yes.
But we'd made some of the ideas as clear as you would make them to a child.
Yeah.
And suddenly some of those bridges started building and you saw these conversations happening. And in that moment, I was like, whoa, we have to do this for adults.
Yes.
Because one, it works really well. And two, they're the people at the levers of industry anyway.
Yes.
And so that's where we need to get moving. So since then, we've been running it for adults. The other part of the story is that we've kind of shifted between different things. So we started trying to work with as many like big media companies as possible to get it out as broadly as possible. And like sports people, we did it for like the GB team that went to the Tokyo Olympics so that they were using it in their speeches and things. And we were working with like celebrities to get the message out. And that was kind of the thing that felt like the most obvious way to do it, because it was like, we could just have a big impact doing that.
Yeah, reaches a lot of people.
And in many ways, I wish we were still doing that. But it's very hard to keep something like that alive because it requires rather regular input of philanthropic money. And even though we thought we had really good proof of impact, it was still really difficult to raise that money. And so we ended up starting to run stuff for big businesses.
Mm.
The theory being that you can get into these businesses and reach huge numbers of people through them that wouldn't necessarily engage with this stuff otherwise, but it's mandated by the organization.
Mm.
And you can not only help those organizations to become more sustainable in transition, but you can also create a movement of these people within who are often in like economically quite powerful positions, and they can move stuff as well. So we're now focusing on that, which is a different kind of world and a different part of the story, but it's why we're a lot less public facing now and we're focusing in.
Yeah, and very effective. I mean, I did one of the courses. I think you put one on for EHF Fellows, and that was the one that I joined. It was great. Yeah, and so by making it more fun, I guess you're taking the complexity of climate science and then you're making it accessible and engaging, right? So like, what are some examples of how that would look for someone experiencing one of the courses?
So in order to make it accessible and engaging, the most important thing is that the writer and the person presenting it are genuinely really excited about it.
Yes, makes such a difference.
Because so much of science is communicated in a way where it's kind of being communicated downwards in a way that's like, I know this thing and I am telling it to you.
Mm.
And instead, if it comes in a way where the person who's communicating it to you, it's like they've just heard it themselves.
Yeah, like we're discovering this together.
Yeah, and I know that's really simple, but I think that's really important, especially when it's complex stuff, because that energy kind of draws people through. Of course, explaining it in a way that's followable is useful, which
yeah,
I think is
it helps a lot.
Takes some practice. But a good example of a thing that I learned recently.
Yeah.
Whales.
Whales. Love them.
Earwax.
Okay.
Whales don't really have ears in the same way that we have them.
No.
If you think about it.
No, just little tiny holes.
It's nice to imagine that they could have ears in the same shape as ours, but scaled up. Instead, they've kind of evolved to like cover up that ear canal. So they've still got like the mammal ear situation going on, but then it's like totally covered in skin.
Ah.
But they still build up earwax.
In their secret hidden ears.
Yeah. But unlike us, they can't get rid of it because there's no access to the outside.
How do they push it out?
They don't.
They just accumulate earwax
for their whole lives.
And they have long lives.
Yeah.
So we're talking quite a significant amount of earwax.
Yeah. But
is it like compacting in there? Okay.
But what's really interesting about that is that when a whale dies, you can then take this earwax and then you can see the layers that have built up over time. And you can tell.
You can tell how old it is.
You can tell how old it is. You can also tell the hormones and things that were circulating in its bloodstream at certain points.
Interesting.
So you can tell when the whales were more stressed.
So if
you take a bunch of these things and you map out the last 100 years or so, then you can literally see when the Second World War was happening because there was all the bombing and stuff going on in the ocean, all the depth charges. And you can see the effect of whaling. You can see the effect of whaling stopping.
Wow.
You can like map it out in terms of whale stress. So you can like see the emotions of the whales through this.
What a crazy graph.
Yeah.
Just, I've never heard that before. Is this just recently been discovered or is this?
I don't know how I've just recently discovered it.
Yeah, wow.
Which is why, yeah.
Amazing. Yeah, so that kind of thing, like you throw that into a course and I feel like you just get people's attention because people are sort of sitting there like, this is going to be another boring seminar. I've been to these before. And then you get a few of these facts and you're like, oh, wow. Oh, and your brain starts kind of sparking. And then, yeah, you've got someone engaged.
It needs to be a little bit magical.
Yeah,
just
I agree.
A little bit.
Yeah, I think that's amazing. And then on the subject of facts, because you're a guy with many great facts, can you share some of the most surprising or maybe lesser known facts about climate change that you wish people were aware of?
Could I broaden this to kind of natural systems or sustainability as a whole?
Feel free.
Okay, so I think one of the most important ones is plastics.
Mm.
I think most people still seem to think that the biggest problem with plastics is that they get into the ocean and they choke creatures and they block airways or creatures get tangled with them. And that is a problem. But I think that one of the things that is really seriously underplayed and really kind of dangerously unknown is that actually the really big problem is that when they break down into tiny pieces, and I'm sure you'll know this, they are perfect magnets for loads of the pollution that's in the ocean because they don't like water. I mean, you can see that when you have a piece of plastic and there's like a little bubble of water on it. It doesn't really want to stick to it. It kind of wants to bunch up by itself. Mm. And so instead of attracting the water, the plastics attract all the things like pesticides and fertilizers and loads of horrible stuff that has kind of run off into the ocean. A lot of this is kind of forever chemical stuff that doesn't really break down. And so the plastics themselves become like these ultra concentrated poison magnets.
Ugh.
And then as the creatures in the ocean eat these things, they'll then absorb that stuff, but then they'll pass out the plastic and then the cycle will happen again. It will just kind of cover in poisons again and so on.
Mm.
And all these poisons then accumulate in the food chain, which is our food chain as well, because it's not really a food chain. It's a web of complex things, which means that plastics are the perfect system for poisoning ourselves on a grand systemic scale. And I just think that is something that is not understood enough. And I think that you see that food companies really do try to represent plastic as important because it's important for food safety because bacteria and things can't get through it. But the thing is, I think we have to think of it as like a sliding scale. And the more safe it is in terms of bacteria and so on not being able to get through it, the more that it also can't break down.
Mm.
You can't have both. You are going to have to compromise on the safety in order to get it to a point where it can break down more easily.
Mm.
And I know that this is something that you think about all the time, but I just think that's something that is not well understood enough.
Yeah, that's a really good one.
And I had one more. Oh yeah, copepods.
Oh, those horrible little things.
No, copepods.
Oh, I didn't think.
copepods. Yeah, yeah.
What's
they're
like, it?
They're like these tiny little crustacean-y creatures in the ocean.
Oh, copepods. I can't picture what one looks like.
Oh, they're so cute. You should look. I'll show you some afterwards.
Okay, yes, send me some photos.
But they are one of the most important things for fighting climate breakdown.
Oh.
And no one really knows what they are.
No, including me.
They kind of, each day they migrate from the depths of the ocean.
Okay.
Up to the surface. And there are so many of them that when they do so, it's thought to move as much water as the moon moves when it moves the tides each day. Like it's a crazy amount of water because there's so many of them. And they come to the surface and they gobble up all of the like algae things that have been, you know, feeding on sunlight all day.
Mm-hmm.
And when they do so, they'll then poo out all of this like carboniferous matter.
Yeah.
And it'll go down to the ocean floor and it'll get buried in sand.
Okay.
And that's one of the main mechanisms that is constantly pulling carbon out of carbon dioxide, out of the atmosphere, and helping to clean up. And I think people really don't appreciate how important they are.
We need a big shout out to the copepods.
Oh, yeah.
Look at all the work they're doing for us.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of copepods.
Wow,
think about them a lot.
I am too now. I'm going to look up these little guys.
I don't know if we've got time, but I've got another thing actually.
Oh, throw it in there. I like the first two.
Stability. I think that something that is not understood enough about the climate emergency is that we like to think of it as this kind of linear thing where we just go a bit further and it'll just get a bit worse, a bit further, a bit worse and so on. And I think that it's easy to forget the stability that we exist in with all of nature around us. And I think if you compare Earth to the moon, which is right next door to us, the moon varies between like minus 130 degrees Celsius and up to like 120. And here we don't get anything like that variation because we're cocooned in this like beautiful bubble of nature that's constantly stabilizing everything. And as we destabilize that, no one really knows what's going to happen. I think there's something that Johan Rockström's now starting to talk more and more about that, which is...
Yeah, with the planetary boundaries.
Good, yeah. But I remember in the early days, I would talk about that a lot and I would get told off by people who'd say like, we need to focus on the carbon because that's like the thing. And it's taken long enough to get to that point in the argument. But for me, it's felt like for a long time that it's much more important that we're thinking about nature as a whole. I kind of think that's one of the biggest communication failures ever is that we are led to believe that it's just about carbon and emissions rather than the collapse of nature as a whole. I also think that there's a big problem there with, because that kind of one-dimensional thinking of just thinking about carbon emissions, we're trying to solve the problem with the same kind of thinking, i.e. one-dimensional profit-seeking, that caused the whole problem in the first place. And there's something in that as well. Sorry, I ended on a low one.
Yeah, we could have put that one in the middle and then end up with the copy pods.
Copy pods cool, though. Look them up.
Those are great facts. You've already kind of touched on this, but I was also interested to hear your thoughts on the importance of storytelling in environmental activism. That seems to me like that's the method that you've really harnessed with what you're doing. So, yeah, tell me a little bit more about that.
I think it needs to evoke emotions, because we really evolved to be quite unreasonably optimistic. Nothing would work in the world if we weren't, on average, pretty delusional about the future being better.
Yep.
And further to that, we're genuinely sick if we spend too long worrying or feeling that the future is going to be worse. And I know that's a very strange thing to think about, because the future is looking really scary, and it's a very reasonable place to be in to be really worried about that. But at the same time, sitting in that for a long time, I mean, these things are what poor mental health are. So we're in this bizarre situation where to be realistic about the future is to kind of be in a state of poor mental health. And so this means that everyone, even people like me who are like in the thick of it and like yourself, I get really unreasonably optimistic over and over. And I wrote a thing recently about a kind of pendulum of optimism and pessimism. And I think that it's important for us to freely swing between the two extremes, because I think we need the optimism in order to recharge and in order to be healthy. And in order to take action. But we also need the pessimism in order to be realistic and in order to learn many things that we need to know. And so I kind of think, like, where do I do my best work? And I think I do my best work when I'm in the swing from optimism to pessimism. But I'm also very aware of the fact that, like a pendulum, you can't stay in any one position.
No,
so you have to allow it to keep moving, or at least help it to keep moving. Otherwise, things get bad health-wise. So there's that. And then I also think making things about nature is really important, because the animal emojis are some of the most important in marketing for a reason. Cave paintings were most frequently of animals for a reason.
Like, yeah, this is true.
We love nature, or
we
at least
do.
We're born to love it. So by framing the global crisis as climate only, we're not only failing to tell the truth, but we're also failing to connect people with the stories that truly motivate everyone. So, yeah. Sell the brownie, not the recipe, is probably another important one. You've probably heard that phrase many times before.
I like it. And I like the picture of the pendulum too. I haven't thought about it that way before. So, obviously, like you just talked about with the swing of optimism to pessimism, there's going to be some pretty big challenges that you face in your work. How do you stay motivated? How do you get back to the optimism side of the pendulum when things get a bit tough?
For me, for a long time, the problem has been the mechanistic nature of, like, building an organization.
Right.
In a market society. That's the thing that I found quite hard, because for me, the main thing that pulls me to the optimistic side of the pendulum is doing the things that I love. So, like, inventing things and creating things and, like, connecting with different people and trying to draw ideas together. So I think for me right now, the biggest difficulty is having to be the organizer and administrative person. But I think you're probably more asking about, like, climate anxiety stuff. So I think with that, it's kind of a similar thing where I think it's all about acting. If you're acting and it's meaningful, then it's easier to feel balanced and okay.
Yes.
So,
because you know you're actually doing something.
Yeah.
Rather than just sitting at home feeling worried.
Although I know that not everyone can do a lot of things. Like, it's quite normal to find yourself in a place in life where the best you can do is just look after yourself.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really, I really want to actively encourage people who are feeling under that much pressure and stress to not feel the weight of this. And I know it's very hard when you have a big understanding of it, but there are a lot of people who do have the resource and time and energy to do stuff who are in a reasonably good place and maybe could pour a bit more time into working on this stuff.
So they're kind of bearing some of the load. So then what advice would you give to someone who is sitting there listening to this and feeling really passionate about making a difference? They've got some time and resource, but they're a little bit overwhelmed. They don't quite know where to start. What would be some practical steps they could take to contribute, even if it was quite small?
Number one, shift your diet, because you can do that every day. And by doing so, you're normalizing it for society. I think that's really problematic when we think of ourselves as a number on a spreadsheet of carbon saved. I think that we should really think of the actions we take as making ourselves a node in this kind of network of change, this cascade of change that's occurring. Mm. And so I think when we change our diets, we should think of it as, yes, we're having a direct impact ourselves, but also we are influencing people around us, even if it's very indirectly. And food really gets to our heart, like semi-literally.
Yeah.
And I strongly believe that if we all eat with the largest system of planet Earth in mind, then we're part of the biggest, most important kind of wave of change, like I said. So food would be a good place to start. Also, it's an interesting thing where you can start with something really small with food. If you haven't done very much before, if all you do is eat less of one of the most damaging meats, like one of the ruminant meats, like lamb or beef or something like that, then that's just a small thing you can own, and you'd be surprised at how quickly it might tumble into other things that you might feel that you want to do in your life. Something quite interesting about us humans, which I find really interesting watching myself go through this, is that we like to think that our actions follow our beliefs, but I actually think that it's a lot the other way around, where we take certain actions and then our beliefs kind of adapt in order to justify them.
Yeah, because it's proven. Yeah, and then we also see the result of the action, right? Which then strengthens our belief.
Exactly. So I think food's a really important one.
And so around the food, just getting a bit more specific. So decreasing meat would be kind of your first step.
Well, coming from a farming family, I know how difficult this is as a conversation point when you're not bringing farmers along as well, because I know what it's like to be a farmer and how much pressure that you're under, and how a lot of the time you don't have that much freedom because you're being really pressured by a financial system that's kind of forcing you to make certain decisions. Like a lot of those decisions are kind of out of your hands. Mm. And so I really feel for farmers knowing that like there has to be the political support to get people through this, but really genuinely, beef and lamb are so, so bad for the planet. It's such an inefficient way to create food through those animals.
Yeah, the calorie conversion just doesn't really stack up too well.
It's off the charts bad compared to almost every single other kind of like mainstream food that you can possibly get hold of. And so I think it's such a no-brainer to start with them.
Yeah.
If everyone cut out beef and lamb, then we could probably, I don't know the exact numbers off the top of my head, but I imagine just like kind of calculating this in a mental back of envelope, you'd probably free up about like 20 to 30% of the farmland on the planet.
Wow.
And then you could just rewild all of that.
And the trees.
Yeah, you could just rewild it, as in you could still create the same amount of food. They're just such inefficient things to create food.
Yeah.
Sorry, did I say 20 to 30% of the farmland, not the land?
Yeah, farmland, agricultural land.
I need to check those numbers, but seems around right there.
Wow. Okay. Well, yep, that's a good and relatively easy place to start. And then creatures. You love creatures.
Oh, yeah.
I like all your creature facts. Is there any creature, big or small, that you found yourself feeling intrigued with recently?
A beetle that grows like a termite on its back from its own body. And the termite that it grows out of its back is like multiple times bigger than the beetle itself. So it's like a tiny beetle disguised as a really big termite. And then it uses it to sneak into termite nests, and then the other termites feed it. That's pretty good.
Wow, that's pretty clever. So it just feasts on everyone else's hard work.
Yeah. Going to say, it's pretty parasitic. But it is kind of cool as an adaptation.
Wow.
Another thing I found really cool recently, you'll definitely know this, but cabbage, broccoli, cauliflower, kale, Brussels sprouts, collard greens, Savoy cabbage, kohlrabi, gai-lan, all these vegetables.
All the same, right?
They're all the same plant.
Yeah.
I only found that out quite recently.
Same. And same with mushrooms. Like portobello mushroom, button mushroom, same mushroom.
Really?
Yeah. The portobello just grew for longer.
Wow.
We've been fooled.
We have been fooled.
Fooled for so long.
I'm glad that we've been fooled. Yeah. Because it brought us.
It makes it seem more interesting.
Yeah.
And I'm also wondering about sort of inspiration. I imagine you're someone who reads quite a lot, or at least researches a lot of different topics. Are there any writers, thinkers, philosophers who have particularly inspired your mahi?
One comes to mind, actually, which I just put on my Instagram, a quote, wait, I'll grab it. M.E. Rothwell. Mm-hmm. He's talking about phones. He says, "We've become archivists of the self, curators of a life half-lived, each countless photograph of a wonder, of dinner, of a view, of our children, of the utter banality of our everyday lives, was not a memento, a way of remembering the things we did, but instead evidence of the poverty of our engagement with the present moment. We frame our lives through lenses, filters, and screens, trading the chaotic beauty of reality for a sanitized, editable version. Our photographs are not memories. They are advertisements, billboards for a life we are too preoccupied to live." I don't actually know how much I agree
with
that.
That's also a hard-hitting one, that one.
Yeah, I was going to say, photos are pretty good, I think. But as long as you do a quick photo and then get involved.
And then move on with, yeah, enjoying the present rather than just being on your phone.
Yeah, but anyway, that was one that was making me ponder
recently. Yeah, I'm going to ponder on that a little bit more as well. I've been thinking about this quite a lot lately. We'll discuss this more offline. And I'm also wondering where you go in nature when you need to recharge. So you have a deep connection with nature yourself that I guess is fueling a lot of your efforts and a lot of your motivation. Are there any spots that are like your go-to Matthew spots?
The spot that is most important is just where, like, listening to the sound of the rain. God, I love rain.
Yeah, so soothing.
Rain's great. And I also get this like soul nostalgia thing, you know, I don't know if you've heard that, you've probably heard that word before, but it's like, it means like a kind of nostalgia for your home planet as if it's being lost, which is a feeling that a lot of people who are working in environmental space get quite a bit. But I get that a lot when it rains because I think about how the rain will be different in the future. But so rain for me is really important. And otherwise, I really like getting really close to insects and watching them clean themselves. That's great. I was at a festival once and I was just sat watching this insect clean itself. And then this child came up behind me and they were like, "What are you looking at?" I was like, "Look, this insect's cleaning itself." And they're like, "Oh." I was like, "No, look." Anyway.
They didn't want to join in?
No, they did it. They did eventually. And then they were like, "Okay, this is pretty sick."
So meticulous. They really cover every tiny little bit.
Yeah. Anyway, so that would be a recommended recharge for anyone who is interested in insects and cleaning.
Yeah. All right. Look out for an insect, people. Yeah. You see one cleaning, engage. Well, this has been very entertaining. I think we could go a lot longer. I would like to hear all the rest of your facts, but perhaps over a dinner sometime. And I'm very much hoping that we end up convincing you and Bella to move to Raglan. It's still, you know, it's on my goals list.
Could happen.
Mm-hmm.
Could happen.
Yeah, and it's very reassuring as well, just knowing that people like you are out there doing what you're doing.
Likewise.
It's so important. And like you said, not very many people have the capacity to do it. And so you're actually bearing a lot of the weight on all of our collective behalf. So thank you so much for
what
you do.
Same as you, Tesh. Thank you to you too.
Thanks for listening to the Vibe Lifter podcast. We hope that tuning into this interview has lifted your vibe. Check out raglanfoodco.com to learn more about the people and projects we're stoked to be supporting. A body's a true hobby, the one to shake the sun and down. I follow through with the dish that you play.